Receiving this message. We are Ken Jennings and John Roderick. We speak to you from our present, which we can only assume is your distant past, the turbulent time that was the early 21st century.
Fearing the great cataclysm that will surely befall our civilization, we began this monumental reference of strange and obscure human knowledge. These recordings represent our attempt to compile and preserve wonders and esoterica that would otherwise be lost.
So whether you're listening from an advanced civilization or have just reinvented the technology to decrypt our transmissions, this is our legacy to you.
This is our time capsule. This is the Omnibus. You have accessed entry 399.JB1909, certificate number 21917, Einstein's brain.
What science strives for is an utmost preciseness and clarity of concepts as regards their mutual relation and their correspondence to sensory data.
It's a little hard to believe in hindsight, and maybe even at the time, that the biggest celebrity of the 20th century, the age of celebrity, was not a rock star or a screen idol, but a theoretical physicist.
A Jewish physicist from Central Europe.
Right. The thing that we all love in the 20th century, Germans.
Yeah. Well.
Why was that? How did
he... Well, he's very photogenic, right? He had the cool hair.
You think it's the hair?
The mustache.
He had like uncombable hair syndrome. That's what some doctors now call it. Like just so seriously.
Right?
So wispy that like, I mean, he could have pomaded his hair, I guess, and got it to sit down.
Right.
But he's Einstein. He doesn't care.
Yeah, right.
And that's just how it comes out of off the pillow every morning.
And that's part of the photogenic, the aspect of it, right? The mad scientist who doesn't care about convention.
But he's got a very expressive face, the dark eyebrows.
But also he was the personification of the triumph of science, which was very much a 20th century artifact.
Do you remember those days, John? What it seemed like science had won?
But you know, in the 19th century, science was competing against nature and superstition. And by the 20th century, we really felt like we've conquered disease, we've conquered the stars.
So it makes sense that the big cultural celebrity is not a painter or a poet.
Yeah.
But it's the voice of our time.
Right.
A scientist. He understands the universe.
Yeah. And by kind of celebrating him, we're smarter ourselves.
But it does seem limited to him. You know, like there were, I think earlier in the century, you would occasionally see like Robert Millikan or Ernest Lawrence or somebody on the cover of Time magazine. So, you know, it was still like, hey, guess what? You know, science moves forward.
Yeah.
But nobody like Einstein.
When you're mocking somebody, you don't go, oh, great, Marie Curie.
Nice job, Robert Millikan. Good, nice oil drop experiment.
No, it is true, right? That Einstein became a byword.
Yeah. And, okay, so a couple of years, I don't know, it was like 10 years ago, I was looking online about book promotion best practices, because I must have had a book coming out.
Yeah, you must have.
Well, I don't, why else would I be reading up on book blurbs and tours and
you
stuff?
You also put out a book every year. You're the most prolific artist I've ever met.
I wish. How come I'm not the Einstein of the 21st century?
Don't they call you that? Didn't people over the years say, nice job, Einstein?
Well, here's the story. So I find somebody talking about how, like, you know, don't rely on the publisher to do this stuff for you. You need to be out there selling, talking about your book.
That's what they say to us musicians, too.
Yeah, it's not the label's responsibility. Why would you think we, a massive corporation, would be good at marketing and selling your record? That's not our job.
Don't rely on the people who have come into this explicitly to sell your record.
Even though my job says marketing manager, I'm not actually going to talk to or help you.
No. Get out there and hustle. That's what writers and artists are really good at.
I've been very well supported by my publishers. I'll say say, just in case they're listening.
Sure.
But publishers increasingly are like, oh yeah, how many social media followers do you have? Can I see your Instagram? Like, do you know any bookstore owners in the Midwest?
Do you remember on Twitter when it was a big thing to go buy 200,000 followers from some bot farm?
Oh yeah.
Is that still a thing? Well, who knows? Nobody's on Twitter.
That's how I got mine, I guess.
But that's the thing, that whole idea of you have a million followers?
That was the equivalent of Einstein. That would measure your 21st century clout.
Yeah.
But anyway, this person ended with like, oh yeah, you think you're just going to like, your book's just going to sell itself or your publisher's going to do it? Like, good thinking, Ken Jennings. And I was like, well, hey, like I literally thought, I can't have them talking about me like this in publishing. What did I do? Why do people think I didn't sell my book? I was trying to think back, like, is that what Random House thinks? Because I did all those signings and I did every interview. And I actually emailed the person. I was like, why would you address that? This is weird, but this is Ken Jennings. Why would you say that I'm a representation of someone who didn't do a good job of selling their book?
Right.
And they were like, are you joking? I was just being like, oh, nice job, Ken Jennings. Like, nice job, Smarty Pants.
Had been doing the work.
No, I think it was irrelevant. Like, the idea that I had a book was not the first thing. It was just like,
You were Einstein in this.
Good
job, Ken Jennings.
It doesn't happen a lot. But that was the time when it really threw me off because I thought it was so unlikely that anyone would do that.
How long until that's really a thing where it's like, well, who do you think you are, some Ken Jennings? I bet that's happening all the time in pubs.
I am noticing occasionally that the media cliche of like, I'll take political scandals for $500, Alex. It's now occasionally, I'll take political scandals for $500, Ken Jennings.
Wow.
People are updating the thing, but $500 is not a correct clue value and has not been since the 90s.
I see.
Take note.
Thanks, Ken Jennings.
Take note, op-ed headline writers.
But you are noticing that Ken Jennings is a singular, right? It's a Ken Jennings.
It's always been like that, like Charlie Brown.
Yeah.
I can't explain it. You get it some too, right?
Totally. John Roderick every time.
Is it the rhythm? Da-da-da? They're both the same prosody.
I think it is a very sort of lilty Anglo-Saxon way of saying things. But also, we're named John and Ken.
Yeah.
Like, it's a Generation X problem of, like, there's only seven names.
It is crazy that we're now 107 years later, you know, after the theory of general relativity in 1916, and Einstein is still the symbol of intelligence, such that when I see my name used for that, I'm confused, like, because I still expect it to be Einstein.
Yeah.
Over a century later.
But does Gen Z have any connection to Einstein?
I was going to ask you that. Because you're my Gen Z hookup.
I know. Yeah, let me think about
this. What kind of TikToks have you seen about Einstein lately? I mean, they enjoy the memes. You know, Einstein is now commonly used as a meme for like just an apocryphal story of a 20th century figure saying something that agrees with your point of view about politics or atheism or whatever.
Somewhere along the line, string theory confused everyone so much. And
yeah, people checked out of just like, say, cosmology.
What? Yeah, and now in order to explain like, oh, so Einstein, but then what we concluded from that was a thing that no one, even the people who've spent their lifetime studying it, can't really describe it to you in any meaningful way.
But whereas us as Gen X, I can't remember a time when I didn't know that Einstein was E equals MC squared.
Right.
Maybe because it's a nice short punchy equation. Is that, it's that in the hair?
Yeah, and it looks mathy.
Yeah,
where there's no, it's not math. So you put it up there, and it's like, ha ha, you can't solve this.
And but I think eventually I learned that meant mass energy equivalence, and the implication is that, you know, nuclear fission is possible without breaking the laws of thermodynamics. But I just at the time was like, it's the short set of letters and numbers that smart people know.
Yeah, and I've been trying to explain. My daughter's 12. I've been trying to just introduce physics to her in these kind of, or, you know, relativity. I've been trying to introduce relativity to her. And in bits and chunks, she's like, okay. And then, you know, invariably I have to fall into like, well, and now maybe there's an infinite number of universes that are all happening simultaneously and time is fake. And she's just like, stop. So Einstein remains the last place that physics you could talk about around the water cooler.
Because it was universally agreed upon, and it was a little less cryptic.
And you could say,
he would famously confuse people. You know, he'd give some lecture in a New York hall about how time and space were the same thing, and here's the deal with gravity, and the audience would just be like kind of baffled. Like, I don't think he was a great communicator of his own ideas.
He spelled clues C-L-E-W-S, which always was the worst.
Is that right?
Yeah, C-L-E-W-S.
That's his great. That's one of his great contributions. Clues. Was using the old timey spelling of clue.
But all of that stuff, where you, even into our lifetimes, there were observations made that confirmed a theory of Einstein that were celebrated even in the 90s. Like, look, it turns out light does bend XYZ. So there was still new stuff that sort of tagged to him. Until fairly recently.
He still seemed to be ahead of his time.
And I keep saying, God doesn't play with dice. I keep saying, people love the quotes.
People love the quotes. And he had social views. You know, he was not some kind of physics or mathematical savant. I think maybe some people still say his math was not the best. Like, he was broadly interested in philosophy. I mean, in fact, if you go back to 1905, which was his Annus Mirabilis, you know, the year of his miraculous output, when he put out four papers that were each kind of groundbreaking in their field. You know, one on the photoelectric effect, one explaining Brownian motion, the random motion of particles in a liquid or gas, special theory of relativity, and E equals MC squared, mass energy equivalence. That he did all that in a year.
Wow.
How long has it been since the last Long Winter's record, John?
15 years, but I've been working on it this whole time. You know, he worked on that stuff for a long time. He just had, as they say, you have your whole life to write your first record, and then you have 9 months to write your second record.
But can you imagine some band that comes out with a like four great LPs in their first year? I mean, he was young. He did not have a lab or a academic position anywhere. He was still a patent clerk in Bern, Switzerland, but he had a bunch of smart friends who would come over for a book club at his house. Like, this was his secret. He would bounce ideas off just kind of philosopher and mathematician types about town.
And his wife was really smart, too.
At the time, this would have been his first wife, who I think deserves a lot of credit for some of that early work, right?
But how much did he stand on the shoulders of giants in that moment?
Yeah, I think so here's the thing. Like, we think of 1905 as the beginning of this amazing meteoric rise to fame. And in fact, that's not true. Hmm. In scientific circles, people were like, this is good work, but it did not get outside the world of physics and math. Einstein was not yet a media figure, right, just because he had written these four amazing papers.
It was intriguing, but it wasn't. But the Beatles were already, there were already rock and roll bands.
Right. Yeah. And there were equivalents of the Everly Brothers and Little Richard and Chuck Berry for Einstein as well. You know, I think physicists at the time would have been like, oh yes, he's familiar with Landau and Poincaré, and he's working along these same lines. Like, he wasn't just he advanced all these fields, but it wasn't just like it wasn't like a Bob Dylan kind of a thing where you're like, what is happening right now to science because this guy's breaking all the rules.
But this was true of a bunch of people sitting around eating poppy seed pastries somewhere in Central Europe.
They're just eating strudel. That's their secret. Strudel-powered science.
Oh, but you know, this is also before two world wars. So the fin de siècle Europe was...
Yeah, this is where it's happening.
I'm really still so sentimental about it.
Just because the pastry was good? And they hadn't killed anyone yet?
Art Nouveau. I just feel like if there was one place I could go and live, the suits still were cool. Detachable collars.
I mean, that is kind of what raised his profile, was World War I and World War II. He opposed World War I, which was very rare. At the time, scientists on both sides, you know, this axis, the central and the allied powers, or allied.
Allied?
Hey, this is weird. I'm just watching all these World War II newsreels.
Qua?
And they almost universally say, the Allies have landed at Saipan.
The Allies.
Or the Allied powers at Anzio.
Is that just because it's a mid-Atlantic accent, or is there, what happened?
I think people in America were saying Allies into the 40s, and I don't know when it changed, but somebody needs to clue us in.
It's like all the space guys saying Gemini.
Exactly.
Like, knock it off. That's not how that's said.
If you never have to, if you don't go to an astrologer,
right,
if you're only saying Gemini to other slide rule guys.
You know, you wonder whether or not that's all just tied to like Walter Cronkite.
Yeah, one guy.
Yeah, just somebody really influential who just starts pronouncing it a different way.
So on both sides of World War I, scientists were kind of writing these manifestos about how like our side must win. Yeah. You know, there wasn't a big pacifist movement, but Einstein was like kind of the one guy who was vocally opposed to the war.
I think that's still true that the scientific community agrees that whoever is ruling Serbia is maybe the preeminent fixation of our time.
Scientists just can't get enough of Balkan assassinations.
Yeah.
They love it. So when in 1915, on the dawn of World War, you know, the threshold of World War I, when Einstein adds gravitation to his relativistic theories and comes up with general relativity, kind of the thing that really would go on to reshape the 20th century, it was right. World War I had just started, and nobody in the U.S. or Britain or Western Europe wanted to engage with the work of, as you say, these Central European poppy seed eating scientists because they were on the wrong side of the war.
Although a lot of them were Jews, and by the mid 20th century, that was a very different equation.
I mean, that's actually what's going to lead to Einstein's big bump in fame is being a German Jew at the worst possible time to be a German Jew. But because Einstein opposed the war, his work was interesting to British mathematicians, especially an astronomer named Arthur Eddington.
Also a byword for a genius.
Maybe.
What are you, some Arthur Eddington?
Well, maybe could have been, you know? Yeah. Like, these are all the guys who could be being used metonymically and Einstein's stealing all their thunder.
Uh-huh.
What if
their, he's hot.
Their estates are like, hey, does anybody want a poster of Arthur Eddington sticking out his tongue? And people are like, we're good.
Einstein had hot girl energy.
Big hair energy. So Eddington is a pacifist Quaker, so he's less concerned about the politics of engaging with German science in World War I. And he also knows Einstein's a Jewish pacifist, so like the politics aren't terrible anyway. So he decides, he reads general relativity, he actually understands the work, he's one of, you know, few people that can understand the math, and he says, I want to test this and I know how. If gravity really does bend light waves, then what you'd need to do is to observe a star when it's close to the sun. And the problem with that is, I don't know if you know this, John, but when the sun's out,
it's very bright.
It's very bright. Very difficult to see stars. But he had an idea.
Oh, I'm curious.
It's pretty famous. People are yelling it at their headphones right now.
Stop yelling at your headphones. They cannot transmit to us.
Put them back in your ears. Don't take an earbud out of your ear and yell at it like, what if people did that? And what if their left ear was you and their right ear was me?
Damn it, Ken. I've been saying this for weeks. Well, this is interesting to me to hear you condense it, because this is the type of thing I will talk to my kid about and say, here's the experiment from 1917.
So my misunderstanding of Einstein will become your misunderstanding of my misunderstanding of Einstein.
She has read all your smart kid books, and now she says all this stuff where I'm like, that's just what Ken says.
I kind of stand by those, but it's because I'm not talking off the top of my head in those.
Right.
You know, this is a podcast. All bets are off.
Oh, we went to the Seattle Library this weekend.
The big one downtown?
Yeah, and she'd been there a million times. And I said, but have you ever been to the stacks? Have you ever been to the 10th floor? Have you been to the rare book room? Nobody's taken you there. And so up we go. I'm just forcing her the whole time.
Well, the stacks are cool because they're like the...
Yeah.
The parking garage layout.
She's just rolling her eyes at me. She wants to be down in the kids section. And I'm like, come with me. So we go up and then we walk the spiral all the way through the stacks. And she's never seen so many books. And you can just see her like lit up. Like, what? And I'm pulling stuff down like, look, it's the Congressional Record from 1920.
She's like a brainy orphan in a movie who's like, I never dreamed there were so many books.
So many books. And I pulled out a phone book from the 50s and found my dad in it. And I was like, do you see?
And what's a kid's today's reaction to that? Is it was like a magic trick?
Well, the phone book itself was just a miracle to her. But it was a wonderful kind of like libraries. And then I actually said, you know, Ken actually goes to the library and finds things for those books. He goes to the library.
That's true, because Google search is terrible now.
Yeah. And there are things in the library that aren't other places.
So many things.
And she was just like, cool, man.
If I could tell kids one thing, I think it would be that the internet, A, never had everything, and B, is getting worse.
And it was great because the whole first two floors of the library are just people sitting at computer monitors, and a lot of them are unhoused people sitting at computer monitors because it's warm and dry. And then for her to realize, like, this is a library, like, from the old times, was cool.
From the before times.
From the before times.
When people published books.
You know, they're not going to put that 1953 phone book into the internet. It's never going to...
Never.
Never going to make it there.
Now that I've given you 5 to 10 minutes to think about this...
Okay, I'm thinking.
Do you know the end of the story? How does Eddington decide you can see us? You could see a star near the sun.
Does he put
up
a playing card to block the sun and then look on the other side?
He cuts out a playing card exactly the size of the sun.
No.
What if he lets the moon do that instead of a playing card?
Oh, it's an eclipse moment.
Yeah, a solar eclipse is going to happen, I think, in 1920.
But what about all the flares and stuff? He can see past the flares.
Yeah, I guess there's telescopic ways to get beyond the corona and still see a star that's near enough to the sun and then
see the bend.
And then will there be bending? Will there be movement? And he plans this during the war, two expeditions, which end up, I think, happening in 1919 or 1920, where he sends two ships to the South Atlantic.
Because back when a physicist could send two ships anywhere.
Well, he had backing.
Oh, I see. You there, ships.
Don't you know who I am?
I am an astronomer.
He's carrying a little telescope. Yes, sir. One ship goes to Brazil. One ship goes to the island of Principe off the coast of North Africa.
I think I would prefer to be on the Brazil ship.
Why? Samba?
Yeah, you just get down there and weekend in Rio.
It's a better vibe.
I mean, North Africa's rad, too.
It turned out Principe had the better measurements.
There you go.
And Eddington is able to announce Einstein was right. Newton never would have predicted this, but gravity does bend light waves. And this is the kind of thing that's irresistible 1920s clickbait. Like, all the newspapers are like, Einstein overturns Newton. Because what you got to remember about 1920 is Newton was Einstein for about 300 years.
Yeah.
Like, if you were going to be like, if somebody steps on a rake, you're like, nice job, Isaac Newton.
Yeah, right. Apple falls on his head while he's he's napping under a tree, and he realized everything.
No, you could use it for any kind of smart or dumb behavior. If you look at, to this day, if you look at Google engrams of, like, how popular scientist names are in textual use, like in 1920, when Einstein's making his name, Newton is like 5 times the bigger name than Heisenberg or Bohr or Einstein or Curie, anybody we think of today.
But Darwin definitely kind of competes with with Einstein, although in a different realm.
I didn't think to put life scientists on the engram.
Certainly, as a way of describing the world in a politically contentious but ultimately like science
and groundbreaking way, like, yeah, this changes everything.
We're dispelling superstition and religion, really.
And maybe Newton is a little less touched by ideology than Darwin's work would be. I mean, not in the Middle Ages when you could get executed for saying,
right,
here's how the solar system works. But by the 19th and 20th centuries, I think Newton was kind of a, you know, no matter what we think about God, we all agree about Newton.
Yeah. But that image of a globe sitting in a fabric where it is depressing the fabric with gravity became an icon, you know, a simple way of describing it, but also like a real iconic graphic for most of our lives.
It happened overnight. And it wasn't true that Einstein had overturned Newton. Like, you know, he had added to the understanding of classical mechanics with kind of a new special case that Newton had not considered, and that broadened the perspective. But, you know, you wouldn't say that the first, you know, whenever the Greeks or the Indians or the Arabs or whoever came up with negative numbers, you wouldn't say that they had just
overturned.
It disproved positive numbers. Right. You know, it was, they had added to the picture. But the headlines all said, you know, there's now a new genius who proved Newton wrong, and Einstein became a name. He would get fan mail, and his name would be in papers, and he would sell out halls, and he hated it. He was like, he said, I'm burning in hell.
Wow.
To a friend, because suddenly, overnight, he's famous.
And it was interrupting his work, or it just made it difficult to go to the shop?
Yeah, my guess is he's uncomfortable with it, but it turns out he's temperamentally good with it. Like, of all the scientists who really might have just you know, locked themselves in a garret or gone mad or yelled at people. Einstein really thought, you know what? I have a platform.
And he still had a little color in his hair too in 1920.
Yeah, so when he's on the he's on the cover of Time magazine in 1929 and 1938, and you know, the hair's already crazy.
Yeah.
But it's not white yet. And he's just kind of an ivory tower theorist, you know. In the first Time magazine cover, he's literally just lounging in a robe.
See,
like back then, you could do that.
Come on, why don't we do that now? But he wasn't wealthy, right? He didn't have family money. He wasn't. This was just when people wore smoking jackets.
Exactly. Yeah. It's not. He's not an aristocrat. Yeah. It's just like this is his comfortable housewear.
My goodness. We live in such impoverished times.
Because you probably lounge around in a smoking jacket.
I have 6 smoking jackets.
See? You haven't been on the cover of Time magazine
anymore. Not a single time.
You could be on an album cover in a smoking jacket.
It's sort of against the whole punk rock vibe of like, no, man, don't try.
So the funny thing is, if you look at this Google engram, just to go back to that for a second, Isaac Newton does not begin to decline in his textual ubiquity until 1965. And Einstein doesn't pass him until 1970. So there's still, you know, even though his star is on the rise, he's not yet the scientist. And I think what changes that is World War II. I mean, he already begins using his new notoriety, you know, because he's a bit of a generalist for his field, you know, and he was always hanging out with these friends in Bern and talking about socialism and philosophy and, you know, politics and whatever else. You know, now he's got, you know, people, if he wants to talk about any kind of social or political issue, somebody will publish it. And in World War II, you know, people come to know about his pacifism, but famously, he does the least pacifist thing of his life. He writes a letter to FDR saying,
make the bomb.
Dear President Roosevelt, make the bomb. XOXOXO, Albert. He was just afraid the Germans would do it first.
And as we've discovered, the Germans were never in any danger of making the bomb.
And Einstein came to regret that, even without the 20/20 hindsight of the Germans were not close. I think Einstein came to regret that because
he had become death.
Yeah.
Destroyer of worlds. He had become adjacent to death.
He saw his buddy become death, the destroyer of worlds. And then his hat fell off and he whispered something cryptic to him, as we all know.
You saw the movie.
Yeah.
And the portrayal of Einstein as this eccentric whisperer. How did you feel about that movie? We're talking about the Christopher Nolan movie, Heisenberg, right?
The Christopher Nolan movie, Heisenberg.
What's it called?
Weirdly, it's called Heisenberg, even though it's about Oppenheimer.
Oh, yeah.
He was like, we'll name it for the Nazi one, just to keep the box office down. He's such a good ally, he wanted people to go to Barbie instead.
Yeah.
You
mean Klaus Barbie.
Yes. Did you see Oppenheimer?
Yeah.
Well, the better to cast Tom Conti, lovable 80s actor Tom Conti as Einstein, he's very kind of, he's like a chubby Einstein.
Yeah.
He's a jolly, portly Einstein.
Yeah, he's the fun Einstein of Princeton.
But do you really think he should have been like a big guy? Like, send Tom Conti to the gym if he's going to be Einstein. Like Einstein was gaunt in the 40s.
Chonk Einstein.
Einstein's been eating too much patisserie that he apparently snuck out of Switzerland and Vienna.
Yeah, I'm not, actually that had not occurred to me that, because he was a little chunky by 1950.
Is he? I'm trying to think.
I mean, just the like older, a little rounder.
The older he gets, he kind of seems, I don't know. Like, as a young man, he's got chipmunk cheeks maybe, but I guess I'm very shallow because that was my take on Einstein and Oppenheimer is...
That's what pulled you out of the movie?
Yeah, Tom Conti's sweater is a little too... fitting a little too tightly on him.
For me, it was the magical realism of the second half, but I'm willing to say that it was Einstein's.
You're talking about the black, like the black and white Robert Downey stuff, or the?
No, all of the after the bomb goes off, and then all of a sudden it's like a psychedelic trip.
You're inside his head, yeah.
Yeah, and I'm like, I don't know, man.
It's like it's like Dave Bowman going into the monolith.
I thought the first 2/3 of that movie was one of the great movies of all time.
It certainly moves well.
It does.
Like, it's a 3-hour movie where you're always just like, ah, what's going to happen next? Because it's so propulsive.
Yeah.
Kind of like an Oliver Stone movie or
something. But then after a while, it became a Christopher Nolan movie.
The public comes to know in the wake of the Manhattan Project that Einstein, first of all, wrote the letter that inspired the whole thing. And I think by way of the Belgian royal family, even got into the Oval Office. This was a time when, if you had an in with the Belgian royal family, you could see the U.S. president. Today, that's a few more steps of separation,
less so,
I think.
Yeah.
Yeah, less so.
But wait, he hadn't actually talked to the president at this point? He'd sent an anonymous letter?
I think the letter came first, but yeah. Later, wishing to drive home his point with an in-person audience, he talked to King Baudouin or whatever.
And he's he's widely known as the smartest man in the world.
And people know that E equals MC squared was the equation. Like, people kind of think that's the bomb,
which
is not true. Like, I don't mean da bomb. Like, I mean, they literally think that that equation solves for how do you make an atomic bomb.
And I'm glad you're debunking that now.
Well, it's not true. I mean, it's like Newton's second law also doesn't tell you how to put a man on the moon, although you couldn't do it without it. It says that it's not impossible,
right.
But as we all know from Oppenheimer, it took some doing. But anyway, because of that, suddenly now he's on the cover of Time magazine, kind of staring with steely gaze directly at the reader with a mushroom cloud behind him, and like the equation E equals MC squared. I think it might be the first time that a spinning equation is being used in popular culture to convey this person is smart.
Huh.
Not for the last time.
Uh-huh.
But Time magazine might have invented that.
I'm swirling
in science. 1946. They invented Little Man Tate. And so he's now a brand, basically. World War II, end of the Manhattan Project, even though he wasn't that active a participant. Like, that's what makes Einstein a brand, a media figure. Scientists love this because it's a victory for theoretical science. Like, this guy was just doing abstract physics on a piece of paper, and it changed the world. We're going to get funding now.
Right.
So in the scientific community, they embrace it.
They're not jealous of him anymore because he's old, and all the people that were competing with him in Vienna coffee shops. Yeah, it's just like he becomes a grandfatherly figure instead of somebody that all the smart people are going, meh, he doesn't really know.
That's interesting. I didn't think about that because you would think there'd be rivalries, but I guess I haven't read much about it. Maybe by that point, he's pretty much a secular scientific saint. And even if some part of you is grumbling like, well, he just extended Poincaré's work or whatever. Like, you're not going to say that to a reporter.
But not to keep bringing in other people that that walked these hallowed halls, but the Freud, it seemed like subsequent scientists were really about either debunking or unseating Freud. And we now live in a world where it's like, Freud, except
Freud,
nothing that he did was good, but...
Freud would love that because it's all about trying to unseat the father figure.
Right.
He'd be like, you have proven my theories by trying to disprove my theories.
But and Freud also would have been a real celebrity at this time, the rise of Jung and psychology, always casting back, like Freud.
Right.
But nobody was trying to unseat Einstein so much as they were trying to pick up the rugby ball and move it down.
I think later in life, he lived another decade after the war. And I think by that time there did start to be disagreements about quantum physics among the leading minds.
Right.
And I think you would find people disagreeing with Einstein at conferences and saying, he's wrong about the latest developments.
Well, that's just social relativity.
But by this time, he's now has an even bigger social platform, and he's delighted to use it for what he considers good causes and what I would consider good causes. He's vocal about the civil rights movement, for example, in the early 50s. He speaks out for nuclear disarmament. He's on an FBI watch list.
Of course.
He basically becomes, as I say, kind of a scientific saint at his, 72nd birthday party, I think it would be, in 1951. Yeah, he was born on Pi Day, actually, March 14th. He's getting into a car at the end of the party.
Nobody calls it that.
Nobody calls it Pi Day?
I don't know. It's like some sort of let the force be with you.
It's like talk like a pirate day. And I build my life around these made up nerd holidays.
Pi Day.
There's only 106 more days till talk like a pirate day. No, Pi Day is the only one of these I've ever observed because the pie place by our house used to sell slices for $3.14.
Smart. Wait, there's a buy the slice pie place by your house?
Yes. Although I just moved to Ballard for construction.
Oh. You just moved to Ballard for construction?
That's correct. I followed the pie place. I was like, I don't want to be 10 minutes away from pie.
I've got a quote. I just found a quote here When you sit with a nice girl for 2 hours, it seems like 2 minutes. When you sit on a hot stove for 2 minutes, it seems like 2 hours.
That's how Einstein would jokingly describe relativity to children and lay people.
That's a real quote from Albert Einstein?
Yeah, it is. Oh. I believe he said that. But I think that's actually...
all it takes for it to be true.
But I think that's what people get that wrong idea, that is relativity. He's just saying that time feels different.
Right.
That's not actually what special or general relativity say.
He's just having fun.
He's having a good time with people.
Anyway, it's his birthday.
It gets you in the point of view of thinking, like, what if time is not an absolute, but for a different reason. So yeah, he gets into the car at the end of the birthday, but he's been smiling and social all night, and he's sick of it. So when a UPI photographer says, Dr. Einstein, give us one more picture, give us a smile, he sticks out his tongue instead. And that becomes one of the most famous photos of the 20th century.
Sure, dorm room wall.
But I think it's revealing that Einstein loved it. Oh. He ordered 9 copies of it over the last few years of his life for various gifts and stuff. And he would always crop it down so it was just him.
Yeah.
So he did not mind the fact that he was a brand, as we'll see after his death. So this is going to be the rare omnibus where the person dies halfway through. At his 1955 death, yeah, I guess he's sitting at his desk in his Princeton office. He's going to have to do a TV address in the upcoming days, and he wants to talk about the 7th anniversary of Israel and tie it into his belief about pacifism and disarmament. And suddenly he feels a sharp pain in his chest and belly, and he's rushed to the hospital, but his aorta has burst.
Oh, no.
He smoked his whole... I don't want to say he had it coming, but he smoked his whole life. It wasn't well understood that smoking might not be great for your heart, and he thought, like I only do good work when I have a pipe in my mouth.
Yeah.
So he always had a pipe, and he would often...
You know, Chesterfield is smooth.
They're so smooth. I guess when he was walking across Princeton campus, he was well known to see... If he saw a cigarette butt, he would pick it up, and he would empty any leftover tobacco into his pipe.
Nothing smokes better in a pipe than half-smoked cigarette
tobacco. The end of a Winston or something.
So he was frugal.
I guess. I mean, that is...
Threadbare sweaters and so forth.
He did always wear the same thing, but I almost think it was a proto-Steve Jobs thing. Like, if you see pictures of him after the war, he's always wearing an Air Force bomber jacket.
Oh.
Which is very funny. I think somebody gave it to him once, and he was like, this is amazing. This goes with everything. I can wear this every day. And so he kind of did the black turtleneck thing of just always wearing, the sweater with the flight jacket.
I mean, I can't laugh because I used to go around parties in the morning after, if I would wake up at some house and be like, bleh, I would go around the wreckage of the party finding cigarette butts.
Oh, I thought you were going to say...
in a bomber jacket.
I thought you were going to say pills or whatever.
No. Well, pills too, but no, trying to find half-smoked cigarettes.
There's leftover coke dust on this mirror. Let me sprinkle it into my pipe.
There's nothing better a morning after a party than half of a cigarette dipped in found cocaine. That's why I am the man I am today.
So he wasn't in great health.
I'm in great health.
Unlike Einstein, you are the picture of health. He was just the picture of sticking your tongue out at a limo. Now there's graft technology that could totally replace an aortic aneurysm.
But even after it had burst?
I think today there would have been surgical alternatives. Huh. Einstein would still be around. He'd be 180. But at the time, no, he died at Princeton Hospital. And at that point, two things happened to affect his legacy. I mean, probably more than two, but you know what? We're storytellers, John. Let's narrow it down to these two.
I'm going to say two. I join you in saying two.
The first of the two is he has been a longtime supporter of the Hebrew University of Jerusalem, and he bequeaths them his estate, including his publicity rights.
No kidding.
The right to Einsteinimobilia merch.
How smart.
He gives them merch rights, and... It's a fascinating story about how they have guarded these rights, because he did this before there was actually much of a legal basis for celebrity rights. I mean, they would have had the rights to, the copyrights to his speeches and so forth. But today, Thanks to some aggressive Beverly Hills lawyers, it's now kind of recognized that famous people should control their likeness and their name and some and so on and so forth.
But isn't there like an expiration date like Mickey Mouse, or do you get to keep it in perpetuity?
The funny thing is it's a patchwork of laws that's different all over the world. California has very aggressive ones. They were kind of the birthplace of this just because that's where there were high-powered lawyers who were like, you know what's worth probably worth a lot of money?
Yeah, right.
Maryland's estate. Elvis's estate. Chaplin's image. So they kind of got the California legislature to enshrine this idea that celebrities control their publicity. And it's not clear, like, I think the licensee, you know, Einstein's, what do you call whoever controls, the rights holders now,
yeah,
this Jerusalem University, they've gone to court trying to argue in various jurisdictions that they should get death plus 70 years, just like copyright. And I think in general that's been struck down, but they're very litigious, so everyone just plays ball, basically.
Right.
Einstein still brings in about $12.5 million a year.
Which pays those legal fees.
And yeah, I think there's some kind of 50-50 split where this very aggressive Beverly Hills lawyer who told the university, hey, here's what you're going to do, I think he's keeping 40% and they're keeping 60% or vice versa. But to this day, if Disney wants to make baby Einstein infant toys, they pay $2.6 million for a 50-year license. Huh. And the university is very picky. You know, they'll say, okay, this calculator, yes. This commercial where Einstein says this is a smart diaper, no. Right.
Baby Einstein is a brand that continues, right?
Yeah, because Disney has 50 years of rights to his name.
Oh, so big money.
But when you see Albert Einstein's name now, it will often have a little TM after it, because the university panel is trying to make sure it keeps its rights. You know, publishers will tell authors, you can't put Einstein on the cover of your book, and they'll be like, well, of course I can. He's a public figure, and this photo is, we can get it from, you know, such and such an archive. And they'll be like, well, the thing is, this panel in Jerusalem is very litigious, and we would just rather you not.
But is that that's true internationally, but in China, do they adhere to that kind of...
Everyone loves Einstein, John.
Right,
but I'm saying, you're right. I think
I doubt very much that in the publishing, the backyard publishing businesses in Kazakhstan are like.
Do you get a lot worried. Of off-brand pirated Einstein merch?
I mean,
from Central Asia.
More than once, I've turned over like a collectible and gone, this is from Kazakhstan. It's not worth anything.
To this day, if you want to put, even though he's been dead for. We're getting close to 70 years now, right? It's 2 years away.
Yeah.
To this day, if you want to use a picture of Einstein on anything, you need to go to einstein.biz and I'm not joking, and submit a request to this panel of experts that at Hebrew University of Jerusalem that decides what they want to license. And it's
experts.
Einstein Inc. Experts in how much money do we want to make this year?
Super scare quotes.
Do we care about Einstein alphabet soup? Do we care about Einstein dollhouses?
There ought to be a level of scare quote that is above the normal level of scare quote.
And is it something you do with your hands, or is it actually printed punctuation?
Yeah, there's got to be like an exaggerated punctuation where it's like, yeah, I mean, I use quotes a lot in my writing. I just quote stuff.
You're doing it with your hands every time you say quote.
I'm doing it.
You can't stop it.
And I don't want to, I try not to overdo it. I'll sometimes in an edit go back and take quotes away, but I use it as a kind of italics, which is wrong. But there ought to be a level where it's like, no, I am really being sarcastic now.
Here's my idea. It's regular quotes, but they're in red ink.
See? I like that.
I don't know if the words inside the quotes are also red. I haven't thought this through. I think maybe no.
Yeah. I sometimes use italic stars on either side of a thing that, you know, like I'm like, yeah. I still need to emphasize
that's,
this.
That's social media talk because there were no italics on Twitter.
Right.
The other day we had a Jeopardy clue that had the asterisks. And I was like, you know, Billy, I can just read this and I can hit... He was a musician. You know, you don't have to say he was a musician. And Billy was like, yeah, we could take that out.
I don't know why I didn't remember the word asterisk.
Like
the stars on either side. That's not what they're called. Anyway.
Well, Asterix is the Gaulish warrior from weird Euro comic albums.
With the wings on his helmet.
Like, because you get into Tintin and then you're like, I bet there's a bunch of other Euro comic albums that are good. And then you read Asterix and realize, no, there aren't. It's just Tintin.
My daughter is always talking about Gaul. And I'm like, what? You don't know anything about Gaul.
Does she read Asterix?
Oh, she loves it. Oh. Or she loved it. I think she's progressed. Now that she's discovered Billie Eilish, like all of her tastes are changing.
Did she see the Taylor Swift movie?
She hasn't.
Mm. That's the final level. That's the final boss.
Is that right?
She's no longer your little girl anymore. She's trading friendship bracelets at the Eras Tour. Now,
I for one support our Taylor Swift overlords.
Exactly. You don't, yeah, we don't want to be on the record as bad-mouthing Taylor Swift. She's the Einstein of our day. So can you imagine a future where people are like, yeah, nice job, Taylor Swift, just to imply a level of genius that... Just an unimaginable level of genius.
I feel that might be coming.
It's pretty quick, right?
Anytime you have any success in business, you're just like, well, I really Taylor Swifted that one.
I mean, today we kind of have Steve Jobs in that niche as like the...
Some of you do.
Yeah.
You say from behind your Dell computer.
I have an iPhone. But, you know, the myth-making of the great man, the great mind who, you know, single-handedly reshaped the century. We still kind of believe that about...
Yeah.
Steve Jobs, even though it's probably not true, but I guess we always had that with inventors, right? Edison and
we lived
Jonas
in the,
Salk.
In the era of the tech billionaire that was like, you know, Gates kind of set the tone for that.
Yeah, I feel like for me it was Gates before it was Jobs.
Yeah, for sure.
Is that because we were in Seattle or was that true everywhere, that Gates was
the
face of the future?
Gates was the first billionaire.
Right.
Right, that was like a 30-year-old...
Jobs lost all his money once, so he had to start over.
Yeah, so it was like he's the richest man in the world. I don't know if he was the first billionaire, don't yell at me, but he was the richest, and that made him seem the smartest.
And he was rich from computers and not from railroads or cars or some steel, something you could touch.
Yeah, he looked like a very approachable, somebody that you would normally brush past in the hallway of your business and kind of shoulder him.
Just like Einstein, he had the shaggy hair.
Right.
There is kind of a thing in science where it's like, who's got the gimmick? You know, the tousled hair, who plays the bongos, who's got ALS? I don't want to say that, you know, having a fun Stephen Hawking voice is a gimmick, but like that's why we remember him. He was a genius and we don't remember his peers because they didn't have the memorable wheelchair.
That was the problem with Feynman, was that he could do all these things. He was a safe cracker. He was a guitarist, ladies' man.
Right. It's the we remember cracker. We remember the personality, the brand.
Do one thing. Pick one thing.
Did you notice they put a little guy playing the bongos in the background of like Jack Quaid is in the background of Oppenheimer playing the bongos?
Oh, yeah.
Just to be Feynman. So I promised two things were going to happen when Einstein died. And one of them is his estate became this massive merchandising operation. The second thing that happened was his body was brought to Princeton Hospital, where a Princeton pathologist named Thomas Harvey assumed he had permission to do an autopsy and did one, and assumed that everyone would want him to remove and study Einstein's brain.
Yeah, sure.
And he did so, even though, in fact, no one had asked him to do this. Einstein's wishes specifically were against it. He wanted to be cremated and dumped in the Delaware River and thought it would be, I think he's on record. There, you can find quotes of him saying this would be hubris to, you know, delve into the brain as if it were, you know, after my death, you know, there should be no cult of Einstein.
Well, and also, I mean, the Delaware is clearly the Ganges of America.
It kind of is our spiritual home. Have you ever done that pilgrimage to the mighty Delaware River?
Oh, for sure I have. Well, you know, I actually did go to there's a little park where Washington crossed the Delaware, and it's like a nondescript, just little sort of roadside. It's not even roadside. You have to go off the road to find it. And you stand there and you really do a Clark Griswold, like, welp.
Plymouth Rock, baby.
And there's always a little mist on the water, so you're like, yeah, I get it. Okay.
He sure did.
Everybody back in the car.
They should have the boat there, you know, like in the painting. They should have like a replica of the boat so you could, like at the pier so you could pose.
You know, they might even.
I don't know.
It was cold that
day. I've got ideas. Washington should have bequeathed his publicity rights to me, because I got ideas.
Yeah, whatever happened to Washington?
Nobody talks about Washington anymore. Once it becomes clear that Harvey does not have this permission, he retroactively secures it. He realizes
University of Jerusalem?
Yeah, he has to submit. He goes to Einstein.biz, which is amazing because Alta Vista is very primitive back then. He uses his mosaic navigator. No, he goes to Einstein's friend, who's like, I guess, the executor of the will and the estate, and also to Einstein's son, Hans Albert, mm-hmm. and says, hey, I felt like we should cut up your dad for study.
Seemed right.
It's kind of the thing. And it was back then. You know, it was kind of assumed that, you know, a generous thing to do to science would be to let it study your organs if anybody cared. So there was some baseline of, well, of course we're going to do this. It's Einstein and he's got interesting organs.
Did any phrenologists get in there and feel his head before he went?
It's even weirder. Ophthalmologists are involved.
Really?
Einstein is cremated except for his brain and his eyes, which Dr. Harvey has already appropriated. For reasons that are unclear to me and perhaps to anyone, he gives the eyes to Einstein's eye doctor. Hey, you're probably going to want these, having been Einstein's eye doctor and all.
Not his glasses, but his eyes.
His literal eyes.
In a jar.
You're going to want to be staring at these. And I guess it's not clear what happened to them. Rumor has it they're still just sitting in a safety deposit box somewhere in New York or New Jersey, and there's rumors every so often they're going to come up at auction.
Yeah, labeled AB normal.
Nice souvenir. Good thing this guy didn't know Einstein's proctologist, am I right?
This all sounds like the Kennedy autopsy.
Right.
Where it's like, oh, all of a sudden, different thing. He looks different coming out than he did going in.
Doesn't he think that there's going to be more oversight? Like at the time, it's clear this is one of the biggest names. You know, it's just the revered Dr. Einstein. And he's been entrusted with this duty.
I'm trying to picture.
And he just thinks he can pluck out his eyes?
I'm just trying to picture the time. And it does seem like it's still like this would still be sort of a cottage industry or not industry, but like, oh yeah, he died at Princeton and we are all here. And so
let's do some research.
Yeah. I can't believe his skull didn't get appropriated as some sort of like Yorick that sat on somebody's desk.
There's some thinking that Thomas Harvey was not just calling an audible here, that he was actually, that his mentor was a guy named Harry Zimmerman, who was a friend of Einstein's, who maybe said, you know what we should do is we should study Dr. Einstein's brain. So it may be that he was just following orders, as
but if
we
you,
say.
If you think if they had gone and just taken locks, little locks of his hair, tied it with a ribbon and sold it in order to fund the completion of a new
wing at the Hebrew University of Jerusalem or somehow, Princeton.
You know, it's like little bits of the true cross. Like it would go out and...
But wouldn't that have seemed, I almost think, you know, in a time when sacredness was still considered something in the public sphere, like wouldn't there have been more outcry in the 50s than today if you were trying to sell off tiny pieces of a celebrity's body? I mean, that would be tasteless even today.
It would unless, you know, like if you put it in your will, hey, when I die, cut me up into tiny bits and sell me.
People love the story of improv legend Del Close willing his skull to his university drama department to play Yorick in Hamlet.
Did that actually happen?
Yeah, he did, in fact,
do that. And does it get used that way?
Yeah, this guy's generating new stage credits decades after his death.
That's wonderful. Does his estate get paid? Royalties? He appeared in that film.
Let's get some residuals. 3 cents. Anyway, even though Harvey retroactively got permission for this going off the reservation here, he is in fact fired within months from Princeton Hospital, I think largely a result of this incident.
Oh, okay.
But he still got the brain.
No.
Yeah.
He got the permission and that included him keeping the brain?
Well, no, I think nobody else really knows what to do with it. Oh. You know, it's not like there's not an extended legal battle over the brain. It just kind of disappears from the record. But in hindsight, we now know that he went to a Philadelphia hospital, he went to a UPenn hospital, and had the brain sectioned, like cut into like kind of 200 samples, which were, there's some kind of method to preserve the brain, placed in two formalin jars. So he now has two, kind of imagine, you know, peach slice jars filled with...
Slices
of Einstein's brain in solution. Delicious, succulent... chunks of whole fleshy chunks of Kling Einstein and says he's going to do research on it. And for 40 years, whenever he's tracked down and asked about it, he says, yeah, I'm sure working on that Einstein's brain project. Mm-hmm. In fact, he has hit on hard times. The having Einstein's brain in a jar seems to be a bit of a curse. His wife divorces him and actually threatens to go to court over possession of the brain.
The Einstein brain in a jar curse.
And really, it seems well-deserved, right? Like, I don't think anybody should get in trouble for having the Hope Diamond. It's very nice. But this guy cut up Einstein's head.
Is there any... I know from past experience that there are often marital disputes between someone who's into taxidermy or other creepy vampire stuff.
Is that true?
Yeah, and then their spouse who's like, no, I don't...
But don't you know what the scorpion is when you got on its back? I mean, you just married a taxidermist lady.
Well, that's right. And I think it often happens that he'll have a like a squirrel posed in a diorama or something, and she's like, oh, okay. And then it turns out, no, this is what he's really into.
He's got a basement full of pelts.
Yeah. And so it becomes a thing where it's like, okay, you can keep those in your little office, but never in the bedroom. But you and Mindy don't have any... One of you isn't like, I love these Braille Playboys, and the other is really opposed to the Braille Playboys.
I mean, I got a garage full of 1980s Marvel comics, and Mindy rolls her eyes at it, but she's not like, either the X-Men go or I do.
Right.
Which is a good thing, because I think she knows she's not winning that one.
But you know that's not worth anything anymore.
Well, of course.
Nobody wants to buy comic books.
You'd be surprised.
Nah.
No, there actually are. It's actually post-80s. A lot of that stuff, when the industry contracted and the print runs got smaller.
Oh.
There's a lot of these comics where it's like, this is Harley Quinn's first appearance, and there's not that many of them. And I'm that like...
is worth money.
And I'm like, I think I have that in my garage. I think this came up once on the show. Yeah, like, there are like comics from when you were in your 30s that are now worth hundreds and hundreds of dollars.
That's ridiculous.
It kind of is, yes.
Yeah. But Mindy also doesn't have like a collection of like all the different kinds of meth in a jar.
Well, I don't even know what is it's always the husband in these stories that has the weird hobby. What would be the creepy thing the wife has a basement of that's a red flag for the gentleman? That just doesn't happen.
Well, yeah, creepy dolls.
Women are normal.
Think about creepy dolls.
Well, like Hummel or something?
No, like creepy dolls that her grandmother made where one eye won't close and, you know, like...
I don't think women have a collection of creepy horror movie dolls.
Maybe that's also just guys.
Or goths. Maybe I'm not dating enough goths.
Well, you're clearly not. Although Mindy's kind of goth.
Mindy liked the Smiths.
Let's be honest.
And The Cure, but like in a very kind of wholesome Mormon girl way.
But if I passed her in a supermarket, I would be like, goth girl.
I don't think you would. She'd be wearing pastels for one thing. And whistling. Goths don't whistle.
No, I guess not. Or they just whistle in a desultory way across the moors.
Yeah, yeah. Whistling past the graveyard, I guess. So his marriage breaks up. He moves to the Midwest.
Still carrying the...
Yeah.
He's like hitchhiking with Einstein's brain under his arm.
He winds up in Wichita working for a bio-testing lab. And by all accounts, in hindsight, I think he says he used to keep... People were like, well, where was Einstein at that time? And he's like, well, I had his brain... the jars of his brain were in a cider box that I kept under a beer cooler at work. So the greatest mind of the 20th century literally is in a cider box, which apparently we just have to believe that a cider box is a thing.
I'm not sure.
Under a
cider box.
Under a beer cooler.
What are some other examples of like things that would be, you know, like Hitler's photo album or whatever was sitting in some guy and probably also in Kansas, just sitting under a...
This is seductive to you because this is the dream of the thrifter.
Yeah.
That some priceless bit of history is just in an attic or a basement somewhere.
No, we're looking for it all the time. Every thrifter is out there going, you know, why else would you go through everybody's china? You're just, you know, all these stacks and stacks of teapots.
Well, your mistake was going to garage sales and consignment stores. You should have been going to Wichita doctor's offices.
I guess so. But you see this in Antiques Roadshow. Somebody comes in and they're like, this was in my grandmother's garage.
And they're like, that's a Degas.
Yeah, that's a Degas. It's worth $60 million.
So he winds up in Missouri practicing medicine only briefly. He loses his medical license in 1988. This guy, in addition to cutting up Einstein, does not appear to have it together. Maybe it's the curse, or maybe he's just a loser.
How do you lose your medical license? It sounds like he's probably collecting brains everywhere he goes.
Yeah, it was probably all the brains he had. He's on eBay, like, bidding on, come on, can I get, like, Paul Dirac's brain? When's Linus Pauling going to die?
He's living in this apartment in Kansas, but it's cider boxes all around. It's like, what are in these cider boxes?
He has so many cider boxes. He's like, which one of these is Einstein's brain and which one's cider? I'm guessing I'm going to have to drink them all. He winds up in Lawrence, Kansas, working on the assembly line in a plastics factory once he loses his license. He's living above a gas station.
Don't get divorced. This is your future.
Your future is living above a gas station, working an assembly line. And he comes to the attention of his new neighbor, who is no less than beat poet William S. Burroughs.
This story just went absolutely sideways.
It's bonkers. He's living above a gas station, and his neighbor is William S. Burroughs.
And this is William S. Burroughs in which decade?
Late 80s.
Whoa!
So it's like, imagine him in Drugstore Cowboy. That's exactly the time.
Whoa.
And Burroughs loves this guy, mostly because he has Einstein's brain, and Burroughs can now tell friends, I can go poke Einstein's brain whenever I want.
He's out here making records with Kurt Cobain, and then he also knows the guy with Einstein's brain. Wow.
In 1997, he takes a road trip out to California to try to offer the brain to Einstein's daughter, and he brings a journalist along. So I think either a long article or a short book comes out of this, which is an interesting portrayal of what Thomas Harvey is like. Eccentric, yeah. Apparently, but funny.
Sure.
Good company on a road trip.
Went to Princeton.
He worked there. I don't know if he went there.
Okay, worked there.
The daughter does not want the brain, it turns out, it stays in Harvey's. If somebody brought you your celebrity father's brain, which I guess could still happen to you at some point, John, you need to be ready for this doorbell ring.
But like sliced like pastrami.
I'm not sure if it's, it might be more like cubes. Like maybe imagine Spam instead of prosciutto.
Even worse. No, I would not want it. I would want it immediately put in the Delaware River is what I would want.
That's where it was supposed to be. But beginning in the 80s, enough people have heard about this, you know, because this occasionally somebody will write a story about like, what happened to Einstein's brain? You won't believe the answer. And some scientists do request samples. And people do start doing work on Einstein's brain, which means occasionally you will see a pop science story beginning in the late 80s where somebody will say, for example, that most of the samples were normal, but in the left hemisphere of his brain, there's one area where his glial cell to neuron ratio is much higher than the average. And perhaps this was the secret to Einstein's intelligence. Or somebody else will say like, well, you know, the fibers in the corpus callosum connecting the hemispheres were much thicker than in most other samples. This must be the secret to.
The brain study science, the brain science study, science brains study.
There's
science.
Only six orders of those words, so you can pick your favorite.
Had improved considerably since Einstein died, so now people could actually.
Well, they can say they can, but you know, it's unclear. There have been a lot of criticism of this work. Basically, like, look, if you take any sample, you're going to find one oddity. If you study 30 metrics, one of them will be more outside the normal range than the others. And it's irresponsible to publish it and be like, I found the secret to Einstein's genius. It's in area 36 of his left hemisphere.
It's a bunch of blind people describing an elephant.
And that's also true because the brain is dead. You know, a living brain would be very easy to, you know, today we could do an MRI on Einstein. Again, if he hadn't died in 1955, he'd be extremely old. Mm-hmm. And you could maybe see stuff light up and get some sense of really what the secret was. But today with just the tissue after it's been in a cider box for decades, the findings are a little more limited.
But was Einstein any smarter than anybody else? He was a physicist. He had studied physics. He lived in his time where physics was burgeoning, and he came up with some things. But if you were like, hey, Einstein,
Scrabble.
Yeah, which brand of toilet paper is the better value? Is he also going to stand in the supermarket like I do? For a half an hour.
In an Einstein accent?
You must
consider the two-ply factor.
Yes, this is softer, but is this more firm?
I am squeezing the shaman.
So this is, was Einstein smart?
This is the takeaway you want? Was Einstein smart?
No, I believe he was smart, but is his brain, you know, like, right. Is Marilyn Vos Savant more... Is her corpus callosum more?
She's still with us. We need to hook her up to something.
Yeah, we should. But like, what is smartness anyway?
I mean, that's the main problem. Yeah. Like Einstein, was he street smart about smoking
publicity,
a pipe?
Seems like.
Yeah, about sticking out his tongue in a limo. Yes, about picking up used cigarette butts. Mm. Maybe not so much. I think, you know, among scientists, there's a consensus that his work was, you know, it was in the, it wasn't just out of nowhere. It wasn't like, who is this young rebel? He's remaking everything. It's clear what tradition he's coming out of and who he's reading. But the fact that he's doing all this as a patent clerk with just some smart friends to bounce ideas off of, like he's Harvey Pekar in American Splendor. I mean, that is, that does kind of point to a specific kind of genius that's not just the right guy in the right place at the right time.
Yeah, right. But like if you took the top 20 geniuses of the 20th century, not just out of the physics camp, but like a bunch of, let's just get all the geniuses together.
I mean, it's so specialized though.
Yeah.
Like I'm pretty good at Jeopardy, but that's like a parlor game. It's just a game show. You know, it doesn't mean I'd be good at theoretical physics. I know from experience that I'm not a great computer programmer. Like,
you're great at podcasting. Oh, man, I'll say one boy. Of the best.
I'm one of the top two podcasters in this room. Probably the second best one. Thomas Harvey died in 2007. And in 2010, his estate sent the Einstein remains to the National Museum of Health and Medicine in Silver Spring, Maryland. The only place...
who opened a box and were, or a cider box and were like, what the...
Well, it's the end of Indiana Jones. They're like, yeah, we'll just put it with the cider boxes in the basement, I guess. We'll get to this at some point. Some of it is on display at the Mutter Museum. I don't know if I'm saying that right. Do you know that kind of that macabre place in, is it Philadelphia, I think, that has...
That it's like has, a Ripley's Believe It or Not?
Yeah, kind of. I mean, it's a little more classy than that, but it really is like, hey, oh, weird kids, come see the Siamese twins in formaldehyde. You know, there's a little bit of that Ripley's Auditorium kind of a thing. And there you can go see Einstein's brain, which by most metrics was a regular brain. It didn't weigh or measure. People were calipering it like phrenologists after he died, and the dimensions of it were no different from yours or mine.
What's interesting is that although he was an icon of this era of science, and this brain thing seems like a scientific endeavor, it ends up just being superstition. There's something really quasi-religious superstitious
it's
about.
It's like this is a finger bone of the saint, or this is a piece of the true cross, except he's a...
Except it's like stew meat in formaldehyde. And that concludes Einstein's Brain, entry 399.JB1909, certificate number 21917, in the omnibus. Futurelings, social media died an inglorious death a long time before this episode aired.
It suffered an aortic aneurysm while sitting at its desk.
I went to X the other day.
I can't even call it that.
Even though I'm permanently banned. And part of the permaband, it seems like, when I go to X, they've now turned it, for me at least, into just they're deciding what I see entirely.
Your profile's gone.
Yeah, I don't see anybody.
You're logged out.
Right? I'm just like a guy who just showed up. I mean, I'm logged in enough that it tells me I'm suspended every time I go. But and I'm just watching, I guess, what they feed people who show up, and it's sports bloopers and and just a lot of weird conservative crank politics.
Well, you can see that with the ads now. It's
And then it's 20% ads, 30% ads.
And the ads are just goofy, you know. The ads, they wish it was the NFL or IBM, but instead the ads are like, do you think homeschooling is too woke? Send away for our kit.
It's so bad that it's now interesting to me, just in that car wreck sense of like, I'm going to go over there and see how, like, what a morass it is. Not that interesting. I do it about once a week.
I don't recommend that you take the Alex Jones route of trying to get reinstated on Twitter and become a folk hero that way.
No, I have no interest in it. And unfortunately, no real interest in social media anymore. And that's what I'm trying to tell futurelings.
Don't do it.
You don't want anything to do with it. But
don't smoke a pipe.
If you're still looking for something good, try and find at Omnibus Project. Oh, somebody wrote me the other day and said, I want more Omnibus content on Threads. And I said, you are barking up the wrong tree asking me.
Well, I think he needs to become the change he wants to see on Threads, because you and me are not on Threads.
I think it was a she, so.
Whoa.
Sorry, bro.
Whoa.
But what I said was...
I was a bad a lie.
What I said was that weirdo who does Omnibus out of context is on everywhere. So find them. And when I say weirdo, I say that absolutely affectionately. Find that person because they are making better Omnibus content than even we are.
They are because they're taking a very long, dull show and taking out three good quotes from it.
Yeah, turning it into...
That's what we should have done.
Three weird, funny things.
What if every week we release three... We record an hour and a half story about Einstein's brain, and then we just release three random sentences from it. put that out of context sponge guy out of work.
It's just like a long document with everything redacted except for funny things.
Yeah, exactly. It's silence. You listen to it. It's like 20 minutes of silence, and then you'll suddenly be like, he spells clues, C-L-E-W, and then another half hour of silence.
Well, all those people that listen to the show to go to sleep, which is a surprisingly large demographic.
It's literally two-thirds of you listening right now.
People are like, I love their voices. It just helps me go to sleep. And then the next day I listen to another 10 minutes.
I'm fed up with those people. Wake up!
Wake up!
Hey! Get out of bed!
Stop sleeping!
What are you doing?
Anyway, you can email us at theomnibusproject@gmail.com, and we do read those. You can send us actual mail, which we do open and look at, and then Ken leaves here at the bunker, and then
to litter your daughter's nursery.
It is P.O. Box 55744, Shoreline, Washington, 98155. If you do have a sword, your grandfather's sword or your great-grandfather's sword that you want to send me, I'll put it here in the...
Can you put swords through the U.S. mail?
Well, we've already gotten a couple of swords. It's just you're not interested in them, so you forget about them. But what? I put them in my umbrella
stand. I'm just wondering if they didn't get caught. But really, if you asked a postal employee, hey, can I put this sword in the mail? They would say, good Lord, no.
No, I think you can't put a bomb in the mail, anthrax.
Let's agree that we can't put a bomb in the mail.
But you have to be...
But is a sword more like a bomb or a letter?
Oh, a sword's not going to hurt anybody if it's in its. Yeah, there are so many worse things.
A sword is more like a bomb than a letter. I'm going to put that on my tombstone.
Yeah, but half the things you order from Wayfair would kill a postal worker before a sword would.
I guess that's true.
That just off-gassing from all the glue that's in there.
From all the plastic.
So send us your stuff. Ken, you were opening mail earlier while I was trying to talk about something interesting. What were you finding?
I most certainly was not. I'm pretty sure, first of all, that you were not talking about something interesting.
That's confirmed.
The Center for Land Use Interpretation that often sends us their newsletter wonders if we will donate in the new year.
Okay.
And I think instead of donate, we'll just give them this free ad read right now. Who wants to donate to the Center for Land Use Interpretation? Google them. They're on Venice in Culver City.
Einstein.biz.
We got a note from Alexander. He sent us a little homemade Christmas card. Look at this.
Well, thank you, Alexander.
Look at this little thing he made. We're recording this back into the distant past of 2023 to you.
Oh, is this show airing in 2024?
Yeah, late January.
Hey, congratulations, everyone. You made it.
Happy New Year. Happy holidays, Ken and John. What new knowledge does our Prometheus bring to us mortals this season? Who's the Prometheus in this? The show?
The show.
It's been an incredible listening experience getting familiar with your hailed podcast.
Huh.
Alexander appears to be a chatbot, and I'm into that. Looking forward to the next year of it. Thank you so much, Alexander. This is actually a beautiful little handmade and colored card he sent.
Thank you, Alexander. Does it have a return address so we could know where Alexander came from?
Alexander comes from Paulsbo, right here in beautiful Washington State.
Paulsbo.
We can go visit him. I have his address. We'll be showing up at your house. It'll take us about 90 minutes to get there, right?
Does he have a Viking last name of some kind? Let me see here.
I don't want to dox him, but look at that name and address. You'll think it's funny. The answer is sort of.
Too bad, but yes, also.
And you got a gift, John. Thank you. Crystal says, thank you for all your Omnibus sessions. I'm enjoying your whimsical comments and input very much. So you think you're a goth, but no, you have whimsical comments and input.
She thinks that the show is about you, and I'm the color commentator.
Yes, you are correct, sir. Ha, 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 ha. This is good. You two can be so funny. You're not, normally, but you can be.
You can be so funny.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What would you rather be told? You're so funny, or you can be so funny?
You can be sometimes.
Occasionally, you surprise me by being funny. Also, I hope you are still playing music, which you are.
Yes, yes, more and more all the time. Why did you not get included in this
gift? I think you'll see when you see what the gift is.
Opening it up here. Oh, how cool. It's a capo for a guitar.
It looks like it's hand-whittled or something.
It's made of wood?
That's unusual, right?
That is unusual.
I'm no capo expert.
But it's good. It's good for, you know, for looking good
and for the earth.
House.
Good for the earth.
Well, hang on. Let me get just before I... Well, no, it's made out of metal that has been
designed to look
painted
like wood.
To look like wood. But even that is kind of cool. Well, thank you so much.
Thank you, Crystal.
Oh, and picks too. They're picks.
Oh, I didn't see. Are they a type you would use?
I would absolutely use these.
I don't know how picky you are.
These Wingo picks. No, I'm not a pick. I'm not picky about picks. I'll play with any pick.
Any plectrum.
Not any pick. But I'll play with a lot of
like
picks.
If it has a racial slur, you'll be like,
no,
thank you.
No, thanks. No, I do not play racist guitar music. No, I just, you know, it.
Like picks, if Eric Clapton gave you one of his racist guitar picks?
Thanks, but no thanks. But picks, you know, they need to be a certain, some of them are, I mean, these are 70 or 0.71 millimeter picks, which is right in the middle. So
0.7, that's a thickness?
That's a thickness.
Wow.
So some picks don't have any flexibility and some are too flexible.
0.71?
0.7.
Does this imply that you could buy 0.72 millimeter? Like, how fine tuned does this go?
That's a really good question.
Like, what's a thick pick?
I don't like anything above a 0.8, and I don't want to do anything below a 0.5. Because the little ones, you can't get any, and the heavy ones, you're like, what am I, a bass player?
Right.
Even a bass player, I don't think would use them.
Bass picks are thicker.
Can be. Yeah, because if you're playing the bass and you're like,
it's got to be. I guess I'd never thought about this.
Yeah.
0.71, the correct thickness of pickness. Mm-hmm. I'm down with the pickness.
Anyway, if you are down with the pickness and you are down with the omnibus, let me give you the opportunity to support the show. And we have some interesting news coming in 2024 if you are members of the Patreon community. We're not going to tell you what that is right now.
A cool new benefit coming soon.
But being a member of the Patreon community, it continues to be its own reward.
It's going to be the best decision you ever made.
So go to patreon.com/omnibusproject and just subscribe at whatever rate seems like compatible with the amount of joy you take from the show.
With your values and or Marxism.
Right. And then you have access to already a lot of great additional content and, as I say, more to come.
Make it a New Year's resolution. Last year, you maybe listened to 52-plus hours of Omnibus for free, and that's great. That's compatible with Marxism. But maybe this is the year you give back. To us. Listeners, from our vantage point in your distant past, we have no idea how long our civilization survived. We hope and pray that the catastrophe we fear may never come. If the worst comes soon, this recording, like all our recordings, may be our final word. But if Providence allows, we hope to be back with you soon for another entry in the Omnibus.